becomes hard sometimes to clearly make these distinctions because we're seeing novel applications of the drones every day. You just can't have the air defenders being responsible for this. You also don't want to be firing certainly AMRAAMs, but even AIM-9s.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and this episode explores the challenge of countering unmanned aircraft systems. Last month, 21 medium-sized fixed-wing drones, believed to have been launched from Russia, entered Poland's airspace. Several were shot down, while others crashed, some deep inside Polish territory. Later that month, a series of drone sightings were reported around airports and military installations in Denmark, even forcing a brief suspension of flights. Not a lot connects these two incidents, beyond, of course, the involvement of drones, suspicion that Russia was responsible, and that the two affected countries are NATO members. But together they give a sense of the wide range of threats that drones can pose. To explore those threats, I'm joined on this episode by Dr. Stacy Pettyjohn, a senior fellow and director of the defense program at the Center for a New American Security. From securing sovereign airspace to protecting maneuver formations on the battlefield, the counter-drone challenge is huge. It's a challenge the U.S. Joint Force must contend with, and one facing NATO and its individual member states, particularly those eastern states most at risk from Russian drone operations. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Stacy Pettyjohn. Stacy, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
It's great to be here.
So as I mentioned to you when I reached out to invite you on the podcast, I had read your report, your CNIS report called Countering the Swarm, Protecting the Joint Force in the Drone Age, last month in September. And I found it really interesting. It's obviously a subject, the CUAS subject is one that we're all sort of grappling with. But I found it interesting also that the report was published on September 10th. Overnight on the 9th and 10th is when, listeners will be familiar with a number of Russian drones, mainly one-way attack drones, violated Polish airspace. And I started thinking about the battlefield applications of CUAS and the more general sort of idea of airspace defense, airspace security. And I know that they're linked, but I have this, I guess, ingrained habit to think of things like airport security is fundamentally different from battlefield operations. And that was that sort of gap between those two things was even further reinforced when we saw the Copenhagen and Oslo airports shut down by mysterious objects in the sky. Denmark has said that they believe Russia is behind it. Obviously very different than the Polish airspace incursions. But, you know, like I said, I know on one hand, on a conceptual level, that these are sort of linked to the same thing, or they're linked, they're part of the same problem set, but they do feel like very different manifestations of that problem set. Is that kind of an accurate, maybe kind of conceptualization of what we're talking about here?
Yes, I agree with you that there are really important differences between these two situations that need to be teased out, though they are fundamentally related to the fact that drones are so accessible, they're easy to use, and they are so cheap that lots of different actors have them. And they're being used by states because they have proven to be a very effective weapon on the battlefield, on the front lines, for strategic attacks, and then also by terrorists or potentially special operators, intelligence organizations, to use them in more traditional clandestine type operations deep within someone's territory. And Ukraine obviously did this too to Russia with Operation Spider's Web, where they actually attacked deep in the territory, obviously military targets. But the two issues, I think, are fundamentally related, because when you look at airspace defense, many airports in different countries are dual use, they're military and civilian. And there are different reasons that a potential adversary might target a civilian airfield versus a purely military one. But they're both going to be vulnerable, and those are situations that we need to think through what we do. the solutions might not be exactly the same because of the different equities involved and the different risks, whether it's, you know, very expensive aircraft sitting out in the open that you want to protect and could be vulnerable to small drones, or whether it is just causing mass panic that there could be an accident with a civilian airliner because these small drones are encroaching and screw up airspace and takeoff and landing and sort of create chaos.
So I'd be curious, I guess, your perspective, because we've had, including on the podcast, we've had people from sort of inside the tent within the U.S. military talking about CUAS. I recorded an episode a couple of months ago with the chief technology officer to the chief of staff of the Army. Recorded an episode last year with the commander, then commander of 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division, the brigade had faced 171 way attack U.S. Attacks while responsible for base defense operations in Iraq. From your perspective, kind of looking inside at the joint force and how we're kind of grappling this, as I mentioned, this is a, you know, CUAS is a mission set, is a problem that we're grappling with institutionally. What is the state of, I guess, how we're sort of framing the problem and attacking solutions or trying to develop solutions to it?
Yeah, I think the framing of the problem right now, for the most part, remains largely in the realm of air defense. You know, this is an extension of the air defense mission. It is a new aspect of short range air defense and new type of weapon that you need to defend against. I know the Army is starting to move beyond this a little bit and considering how every soldier is going to be able to protect themselves, but I think they're a lot farther away from really fully internalizing that and what that's going to mean in terms of changing tactics, techniques, and procedures so that everyone is prepared for and knows what to do in the event they see a small drone overhead, whether it's, you know, an attack drone or just a quadcopter that's observing them. Both of those pose potentially lethal threats for various different reasons. And then how they're going to enable, in a cost-effective way, units at all echelons to defend against this. You just can't have the air defenders being responsible for this, especially with the Army's new plan, which places so much of the air defenses at the division level. And when you look at the number of systems they're planning to buy, it's incredibly thin. It would provide a very thin defense. And I think if you can take one thing away from Ukraine, is that if the Army is finding itself in a position to be in ground combat and maneuver combat, it's going to face a lot of drones. Whoever it is going to be using them, and they're going to need to have, you know, an ability to defend against them at the battalion, at the company level. And some of this, you know, it's probably different technologies, but the answer that seems to stand out as the most self-evident one and sensible one is sort of improving the ammunition that's available to different guns and on many, many different types of vehicles, and potentially adding sort of gun trucks, for a better word, you know, Humvees with a gun on back that can accompany ground forces and provide them with some level of protection as well as jammers. But it quickly... I think there's a real fine line here. The U.S. military needs to figure out how to continue to conduct its mission, which is not just self-preservation, but be prepared to defend and operate in an environment which is pretty saturated with drones, because it's hard to imagine that it won't be. You mentioned the soldiers of the 2nd Brigade of 10th Mountain, and, you know, they weren't necessarily anticipating the level of threat that they faced in the Middle East. And to me, that is a bit more akin to what we've experienced in Denmark and Sweden, in that, you know, they were at air bases and they were being attacked they knew generally that it was Iranian proxy forces within Iraq, but they didn't know where they were. They couldn't identify where the drones were being launched from. And they started coming in regularly and posed this persistent threat that they had to deal with. They were obviously in a battle zone, so they could actually kinetically engage the incoming threat and shoot them down. And that's a less attractive option at Copenhagen Airport. But, you know, it's that internal threat where you don't know where it's coming from and how to necessarily stop it versus one that originates, you know, quite clearly across a border with an identifiable drone that you know is made by and used by a state adversary.
You know, you mentioned that the U.S. military, the joint force needs to be prepared to operate in sort of drone saturated environments. And you can only saturate an environment with drones if you make them relatively cheaply. And I've long sort of been skeptical about the enduring utility of the U.S. framework of groups 1 through 5 drones, because, you know, we sort of developed it to describe our own drone fleet because we flew drones in from the Ravens in group 1 all the way up to Predators and Reapers in group 5. We're not seeing a lot of group 5 or even group 4 drones. The one-way attack drones tend to be group 2 or group 3. These are small. They have a range of up to a couple hundred kilometers, payloads of, you know, what, 5 to 20 kilograms. They're relatively inexpensive to make. And then you've got group 1 drones, which are mainly quadcopters. And the vast majority of drones that we see in the battlefield are these sort of quadcopters that are flown at the tactical level, the small unit level, on or what we're seeing in Ukraine. Do we need to, you know, we talk about the gold standard is integrated air defense, right? Where we've got these layers, this integrated network of sensors that can communicate with one another, that can cue fires and interceptors to be able to defeat aerial threats. Is this one problem to solve, CUS, or is the sort of quadcopter, tactical, small unit problem one, and then the longer range one-way attack UAS sort of a different problem that we need to think about? Because I'm not sure if, you know, if the solution to keeping what happened in Poland from happening again is the same as the solution to protecting the airports in Copenhagen.
I think they are different solutions. And some of it is because of the diversity of the types of drones. And you're absolutely right. I think groups 1 and 2 you can put together and tend to be of a certain kind. And there are different types of counters that work against both of them. But when you move to group 3, it's got a massive range in terms of the size of the drones, the range that they have. I mean, it includes some of the one-way attack drones, like there's a Shahed 101 that's much shorter range than the 136 that we all know of. But the 136 has a long range. I mean, you're talking hundreds of miles.
Sure.
And that does put it much more into you know, cruise missile-like territory, very slow cruise missile-like territory. But it becomes hard sometimes, I think, to clearly make these distinctions because we're seeing novel applications of the drones every day. Just heard the other day from Mike Kaufman that the Russians are using the Shahed 136, their version of it, on the front lines again, and using it for sort of deep attack, but as a battlefield weapon in addition to long-range strike, because they're building so many of them that they have enough, and so they're going to use it. It's hard to say. I think part of the solution and what is important that is different is not just the type of drone, because, you know, some of the small quadcopters, if it's an FPV, a first-person view racing drone that has a bomb strapped to it, is a really dangerous weapon. And the quadcopter, a normal one, can just be armed with a bomb that it drops. But it's the sort of legal and policy framework around which determines what type of solutions work and can be effective. And you end up moving from a military problem to a policing problem. And it does become more of, you know, you're dealing with an internal threat in a state. How do you deal with that? If the Russian drones that were harassing the airports up north were really flying off of a ship, that sort of blurs the line further, because they weren't, they wouldn't have been being launched from within their territory. But a big piece of this, I think, does become more of a policing action, and the ways to neutralize the drone are much more limited, because even jamming interferes with other aircraft nearby. So you have to shift sort of and potentially stop an airport's operations. Lasers, you know, have a lot of potential collateral damage going up to space. You don't want to be shooting things out of the sky. And sometimes you're not allowed to, because you don't know if that's a person's private property and they're just up there taking some nice photos from the air. So it's definitely a different problem, and in many ways a harder problem, because of the legal restrictions in place in most democratic societies that limit how you can go at this.
So we think of CUAS as sort of four stages, right? Detect, identify, decide, and act. A lot of the discussion talks about, you know, the act phase. Like, what are we actually using to bring down these drones, to defeat these drones? You know, most listeners will be familiar with this idea that we're using very, very expensive munitions to take down very, very inexpensive drones. It's not actually that hard to take one down once it's been identified. If people remember the attacks, the Iranian cruise and ballistic missile attacks and one-way attack UAS attacks against Israel, you see like footage of fighter jets taking down these one-way attack drones. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. They're slow moving. They're easy to track. It's what comes before that, I guess, that becomes an issue. And in the second wave of Iranian attacks against Israel, there were missiles that were detected and identified, but were allowed to impact because you have, you know, you don't know how many are incoming, and you have a finite number of munitions to fire at it. I guess if we think in terms of that cycle of detect, identify, decide, defeat, which of those stages is the area where we kind of need the most work, or where the payoff is highest in terms of investments, having outcomes that measurably increase our ability to fulfill the CUAS mission?
I agree with you that it is relatively easy. I mean, it's not an insurmountable challenge for a very well-trained military like the U.S. is to do this. And we've seen how successful the operations have been of the 2nd BCT, of the Navy and the Air Force in the Middle East. But at the same time, we're just not doing it in a sustainable way. And part of the challenge with the drones is that they are ubiquitous, and they are intending to drain your resources. So it is somewhat of a cost imposition or a Fabian strategy where they're trying to wear you down. So you do have to find cost-effective interceptors. I think all four stages need to be improved. Detect is really important for finding and giving you enough time to put in place the assets that might be needed to eventually defeat it. So without good enough radars or different types of sensors, you can't necessarily get the aircraft in the air, that the F-16s that might go shoot them down, or get them to fly from wherever they're capping to be able to interdict them in time, and coordinate that with destroyers that might fire a couple of missiles or their 5-inch cannon and other things. The detect piece is huge, and that is challenging because many of these drones do fly low. So it shifts at times. With the smaller drones, they're definitely lower flying. And so, I mean, the second, and I can't remember if the Scott and Anthony, when they were on your podcast, were saying this, you know, at times it was 30 seconds to a minute or two to close the kill chain and actually intercept from the minute they detected. And that's really short, and you have to move really fast. With the longer range drones, they seem to be getting picked up further away. because they're flying higher, and so they're more visible, especially if there are airborne command and control aircraft, AWACS, in the air or something that can see them and then help to coordinate the response. That helps a lot. Ukraine picks up the Shaheds using passive acoustic sensors that are attached to cell towers across the country, and that allows them to know that an attack is coming and then potentially to move some of the mobile gun trucks that they use to intercept them, or the drone interceptors that they use to put them in place, because they don't know exactly where they're going until they track their flight path. I do think the decision speed is another area where things are going to have to be improved and are going to have to be made faster. And that probably is going to involve more automation. Whether you want to say it's magic AI or just automation, the way that the Patriot or the Aegis system has an automated mode. But, you know, helping to, once something has been detected, categorizing it and determining whether it is a threat, identify friend or foe, using computer vision to do that, and, you know, tell a human operator, and then being able for a human operator to quickly say engage, and then hopefully make a smart choice with the available defeat options, because we do have to be smart given the sort of cost imposition challenge in terms of conserving some of our more exquisite interceptors for higher end threats, for, you know, ballistic cruise missiles, hypersonic missiles, and using some of the cheaper options to take down the cheap drones. And that's another area where artificial intelligence could help by suggesting who the best shooter is in this situation.
If we sort of return to the airspace violations in Poland and elsewhere, because there have been actually quite a few of these. That was one of the most reported on in September. But going back over the past couple of years, there have been these in Poland and the Baltics and Romania, both Russian and occasionally Ukrainian drones as well, that have veered off course or have entered other countries' airspace. Is it your sense that those countries and NATO member states see this as a NATO problem to solve, or a problem for each of them to solve kind of unilaterally?
It's hard to say. So, I mean, there's talk of it being a collective problem, and airspace defense has been an issue that the Baltics and Poland have talked about making strides to deepen the integration among their capabilities for a long time. I don't think much practically has happened. But in this situation, I think that there is the potential for more collaboration, because they're going to be looking, hopefully, to use different systems. And I do think, like, cheap acoustic passive sensors make sense for identifying Shaheds or the Gerbera decoys. They can pick up the sound of them. They can give them a warning of what's coming. Right now, NATO is in a position in which, you know, it has a limited number of very exquisite ground-based air defenses, like Poland has some Patriots, and there are some shorter range, I think, cruise missile defense systems, only very few, if I'm remembering correctly, in the Baltic states. And then they have a lot of fighter aircraft. But to really conduct the type of intercept that they did over Poland for those 21 drones that came in, you know, you want to have an AWACS aircraft up. So the airborne early warning and control aircraft is probably one of the bigger limiting factor. And sorting, you know, keeping fighter caps up or on alert all the time to go intercept these cheap drones is probably not hugely cost effective. You also don't want to be firing certainly AMRAAMs, but even AIM-9s. It's pretty expensive if you're shooting down one of the decoys that is styrofoam and plywood. So looking into some of The rocket pods, the APKWS, the acronym that never rolls off my tongue, that have proven to be really effective. They're laser designated. There's a ground-based version. There's an air-based version. Having some guns, that might make more sense. But, you know, finding a better system to, first of all, detect and then in a more cost-effective way, intercept the incoming threats that look like they could actually destroy something valuable.
Is this an issue that sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, the sort of frontline states in the Eastern NATO member states, you know, take seriously, and they're kind of looking at their NATO partners in Western Europe, further away from where this is happening, kind of grabbing them by the lapels and shaking them, trying to kind of wake them up and convince them that this is something that they need to take seriously? Or is there a consensus across the alliance that, yeah, this is really important for all of us to invest in?
I don't know if there's much consensus within NATO anymore. I mean, there have long been geographic divisions that I think have become more acute, and you tend to see that these sort of mini-lateral coalitions of the willing within NATO take action for different types of activities that they care a lot about. And this seems to be an area where some of the frontline states on the East could collaborate and work together. I know the EU, I think it's been the EU, has been talking about this drone wall, which I don't know entirely what they mean by that, but it seems like a bad sort of caricature of what they're going to try to do, and seems to paint drones as the complete solution. While they might be part of it, because drone interceptors have proven to be very cheap and helpful, the Shaheds that Russia has been firing into Ukraine, for a long time, the guns were the best defense against them, but the Russians adapted and started flying the Shaheds even higher, so they were outside of the range. So you have to decide if you're going to fire, you know, an IRIS-T or a NASAMS or a Patriot against it, which nobody wants to do because those need to be conserved. And Ukraine has responded by developing these fast, almost rocket-like drone interceptors that are quite cheap and guided by radar on the ground that can go up and intercept the Shahed higher. So they're building their own layered defense. And that would certainly be something that could potentially be helpful to other NATO states, but it wouldn't be the only piece of the solution.
I'm a little bit hesitant whenever we talk about, or people talk about, revolutions in military affairs. I think that that's something that historians will be able to look at back at with a lot more clarity than we can now. I'm sure there are people that are much brighter than me that may be able to sort of pick up signs that we're amid one. But one of the things that's really interesting is that 3.5 years of war in Ukraine has seen the innovation cycle speed up to such a degree that there's constant evolutionary steps forward that, taken as a whole, do almost represent a revolution in, you know, a revolutionary step in the changing character of warfare. And that's because, what do they say? Necessity is the mother of all invention, right? And there's no greater necessity than that of survival, both as a nation and for individuals. We don't have that. As much as we are actively trying to learn lessons from this active conflict, our survival is not at risk from it. Either, you know, the survival of our personnel, the survival of our equipment, the survival of our nation. And so it brings us back to, you know, the army, I'll speak from an army perspective, is undergoing a transformation initiative aimed in part at speeding up the its ability to innovate and to change, improving the efficiency of procurement and acquisitions programs so that we're not talking about years or decades long pipelines of, you know, to bring in equipment based on lessons that we're identifying now. And yet, you know, we're clearly not there yet. Are there ways that we can, that I guess from your perspective, are there ways that we can speed up our ability to innovate? We're not going to be able to match the wartime innovation pace of Ukraine and Russia, but, you know, is there scope for improvement?
Definitely much room for improvement, I think, in the U.S. military. But I hope, I think you are right. I'm in the agreement with you that I don't think it's easy to determine if there's a revolution in military affairs going on right now. I feel like I've supposedly been in an army my whole professional life with the precision revolution, and I'm not sure that it's ever fully matured. And it's easy to get caught up in the technology and lose sight on a lot of the other factors that matter in terms of how different capabilities are incorporated into militaries, you know, the training that is associated with them, the operational concepts, especially how different militaries fight. You know, the Russian and Ukrainian militaries are in many ways similar. They both come from the Soviet system. They have a certain way of fighting. We know the U.S. military and the U.S. Army would fight very differently. And then geography. The other factor is, you know, the geography of this situation is of a particular type. And this fight very quickly settled into a positional fight with very little room for actual maneuver. And I think that that's different, that, you know, drones could be used to enable maneuver in some circumstances because you don't necessarily begin with these set lines and heavy defenses everywhere. So I think that the U.S. military needs to do more to adopt drones, but it needs to be careful in what it is taking away from this because it's not clear to me, and in fact, I've had Ukrainian soldiers tell me this, that they would rather have more 155 than more FPVs. You know, some of this has been born out of necessity and what has been available to them. And FPVs are a new tool in the toolkit, and the drones are really, really useful. But they are sort of not the end-all be-all in terms of the weapons that they would like to have or would prefer to use in all situations. So I like the fact that the Army initiative right now in the United States is focused on getting small drones into the hands of soldiers so they can experiment. I think it's a really hard problem that I haven't figured out how you solve, where they've delegated acquisition authority down to even the 06 level with the recent Secretary of Defense memo. And that's interesting. I mean, it's, you want these to be treated as more of disposable or temporary items that are kept for a few years. But at the same time, I don't see, and we don't have a drone industry in the United States that can support that. And when you disaggregate purchasing authority that much, I'm not sure you can give enough of a demand to the right companies to allow them to scale, because you're going to want to buy drones and have them for training and use them in different operations, but you're not going to want to buy huge stockpiles of these systems that will probably be obsolete within a year or two. So you have to have a solid industry that is, you know, continuing to innovate and then able to produce many quickly if they're needed.
It's an interesting, I think that's a really important point. Disaggregating purchasing authority makes it difficult. If you're a startup that's building small quadcopters and you see the Defense Department as a primary customer, you know, if the Defense Department comes in and signs a 5-year purchasing agreement with you to supply X number of drones per year, you know, including updated models each year or however often you release new ones, you know, you're relatively secure in investing in the capacity to be able to do so. If you're getting those orders, you know, piecemeal from brigades, you're less likely to do so. I want to ask you about sort of scale, because the name of your report was, the title of the report was Countering the Swarm. And we've been talking about drones as a threat, but a swarm is something different, and it's not just about scale, I don't think. Can you talk about how that adds another layer to this challenge?
Yes, I absolutely want to talk about swarming and just large drone attacks. I'm going to come right back to that to add one more thing about scaling production. In an earlier report that I wrote, Evolution Not Revolution, looking at the war in Ukraine, it's a bit out of date now, but the first part was, I think, still holds true. what you've seen there is Ukraine has more of this disaggregated model with tons of startup drone companies that are hugely innovative and doing fantastic things. They're building awesome tech that can provide terminal guidance on an FPV drone for like $100 or navigation that doesn't rely on GPS that is very effective in a heavily jammed environment and not expensive. But a lot of the units have their own drone companies and their own drone manufacturing. And that the fact that the industry is so fractionalized has been a disadvantage, where Russia isn't necessarily producing better drones, but they've scaled production of them and scaled them in a massive way. And whether it's like the Lancet loitering munitions or the Orlan surveillance drones, and then the Shaheds now and the Gerberas, they are producing thousands of those a month, and that has been a huge asset and enabled their ability to continue to grind on the offensive on the ground. Scale in terms of drone attacks and swarms, you're absolutely right. Almost none of the attacks, I would say none of them actually, have been true swarms that we've seen. And I would define a swarm as drones that are autonomously collaborating. So they're making decisions, and they're making decisions for the entire swarm in a way to optimize the behavior of the whole rather than one individual drone. That technology hasn't yet been proven. We see drone swarms in light shows. I was in Taiwan last week and I missed supposedly this wonderful light show that
they do, but those are, yes. I've seen videos of some of them.
They're pre-programmed drones, right? Yep. So they're not actually making decisions in real time in a dynamic environment about how to attack or how to execute their mission, given the sort of guidance that they've been given. What we have seen most of the time thus far are pretty small sort of attacks where, like the 210, they were facing two or three drones fired, normally 5-10 minutes apart. That's pretty small.
Yeah,
and people would call it a swarm. Now you're seeing like Russia firing into Ukraine at night. I think the highest was 800 drones and some missiles. So that's a complex attack. It's very large. It's intended to saturate defenses and overwhelm them. Still not a true swarm, but a really difficult problem. When you get to the real swarms, I think it's where the problem becomes exponentially more difficult, because shooting down one or two isn't necessarily going to degrade the ability of the swarm to achieve its mission. And very few of the defensive systems can take down multiple drones at a time. Like jammers could obviously knock down more than one drone, but any drone that would have swarming would probably have an antenna that is sophisticated enough to, or a radio to be jam resistant. So that you're left with, you know, pointing and shooting, which you're going to have trouble with keeping up with 20 or 30 drones coming at you that are, you know, taking the place of each other and doing smart things instead of just flying a pre-programmed route. And that's where something like high-powered microwaves, I think, comes in, because it really does just fry anything in the vicinity. It's pretty short range, but it would be that last sort of line of defense.
Is it your sense that, you know, across NATO, when we recorded that podcast, and we also published an article by two of the battalion commanders from 210, last summer, I believe we published it. They talked about kinetic and non-kinetic defeat. Kinetic defeat generally worked. Non-kinetic defeat generally did not, for a variety of reasons. The technology isn't quite matured enough yet. There are also all sorts of considerations. If there are, you know, if you're defending a base near Baghdad International Airport, you have to worry about firing a laser that might also interfere with, or a microwave that might also interfere with a civilian aircraft, for instance. Is it your sense that, you know, there's any sort of consensus, again, across NATO, given the context that we're talking about this, on which one of those holds more promise kind of into the future?
Across NATO, I really don't know. I think people have been really fixated on lasers for a while, high-powered lasers as the potential solution for missile defense, let alone drone defense. And now it is assumed that because drones are slower, they're not necessarily as well, you know, armored as some missiles, shielded, I guess, would be a better term, that a laser would be a really good way to pick drones off. But from all of the folks we talked to, including those in the second 210, the lasers just haven't performed well. And it feels to me like I've been waiting for lasers for a long time. It makes a lot of sense as your magazine independent, you pay for the laser, but the laser still has to aim and then it has to dwell on the target for some period of time. And then it has to re-aim and slew and dwell on the target. And I've seen sort of a video, who knows how true it is, of supposedly Israel's Iron Beam that worked fairly well against cheap drones. But I think we've overinvested in lasers relative to HPM. HPM could fry everything. So the collateral issues with it, I think, are huge. It still requires a big upfront investment in terms of developing the equipment and finally, you know, moving it through all the test and evaluation stages. But its ability to engage multiple different drones seems to be the biggest potential promise. It also doesn't have to worry about, you know, running out of ammunition as long as there's electricity. But I do think with either of these directed energy weapons, they end up really being more useful as base defense, you know, for fixed sites, or maybe a ship that has a huge energy source, and that they're not going to be, or it seems unlikely for them to be near-term solutions for maneuvering forces.
Which brings us back to the question of whether or not this is a single problem, or, you know, base defense is obviously very different than providing security for a maneuver formation, for instance, on a very dynamic battlefield. I guess to kind of close out, I wonder, You wrote this report, obviously, because you have a professional interest in this subject matter. You would like to see improvements made, you know, against this problem set, presumably. I don't mean to speak for you, but if we were to sit down and have a conversation a year from now, what would you like, where would you like to have seen the U.S. Joint Force make the most progress?
For me, it's always the low-hanging fruit and the path that's not taken, it seems like, ever by the military that I get really frustrated by. So the two things that jump out there, one are improved ammunition for guns and cannons, like the 5-inch, but for Army guns that are proximity fuse guided, can go out a little bit farther. And this seems to be a really cost-effective way of dealing with a lot of the drone threat. I think it can be used for maneuvering forces. I think it can be used at bases, you know, if the Air Force actually needs to have some guns, if they're going to take on some of the base defense mission, which I know is a longstanding point of tension. Guns seem to be a really smart and easy way. And thus far, the Army has not invested in this at all. And the Navy has done a little bit because they started using the 5-inch in the battles in the Red Sea against the Houthis. So that seems to be like a clear, proven technology, an easy way to get out capability across the force, and one that doesn't require entirely new formations or actually even weapons, just ammunition. The second thing is at bases, I do think passive defenses are really important. They're really important for missile defense, and they're even more so with drones. Scott Wentz, who is the commander of the 210, had talked about how important it was that they had bunkers and they could hide, because sometimes there are drones that are going to get through. We're not going to be able to stop every single one of these. But the nice thing about many passive defenses is they create dilemmas for your adversaries and help protect you against any sort of air attack. And again, the U.S. military doesn't want to invest in, you know, a hardened aircraft shelter or the different things, because it's not sexy, it's not attractive, but it will be helpful, especially in the Pacific, if you're thinking about some sort of fight with China. And then the third thing I would say in the long run is investing more and seeing if you can get HPM over the line as the next generation technology, because it does seem like it could be a really useful last line of defense for prioritized installations.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me again, Stacey, on this episode of the MWI podcast. For listeners, if you know, we didn't really touch on some of the geopolitical elements of this or some of the assessments of, you know, the Kremlin's strategic objectives with the airspace violations that have occurred. If listeners are interested in that, you were a guest along with Mike Kaufman on CNS's Brussels Sprouts podcast a couple of weeks ago. If listeners are interested, I highly recommend they go and find it because it's a fantastic discussion that I think hopefully this one complements quite well. So Stacey, thank you again.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.